Hi, this is Joe Castellano. Welcome inside China Basin, your San Francisco Giants three times a week podcast brought to you by TPC Harding Park, the only public golf course in San Francisco offering golfers the opportunity to play where the pros play. Today's guest is John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle. But before we talk to John, I want to tell you about my favorite golf course, TPC Harding Park in San Francisco. As I was thumbing through Golf Digest, I found that TPC Harding Park is recognized as one of the best places to play in America. And that didn't surprise me too much because I love the majestic layout and beautiful amenities. My San Francisco resident card gives me a great rate at TPC Harding Park, and I get to play where PGA Tour icons Jack Nicklaus, Phil Mickelson, and Tiger Woods have played. Now, if I can only score like them, okay, I'll stop dreaming and get to our guest. And John Shea joins us from Denver, Colorado, where the Giants just got finished splitting a four-game series with the Colorado Rockies. And John, the 25 games left here, Giants are 7.5 behind the Dodgers, 8 back in the loss column. It really means that the Giants are going to have to win most of those 25 games. It looks pretty impossible, but how are the Giants looking at it? What kind of attitude do they have about the plight that they have?
Well, I think they realize it's going to have to be an all-time comeback, and the Dodgers are going to need an all-time collapse. And I think that happened once in New York, right?
Exactly.
But in this case, listen, the Giants got swept in L.A. They came to Denver, lost the first two, extended their losing streak to 7. They actually had a players-only meeting before the game Saturday. And Madison Bumgarner shared this information. He didn't call the meeting, but he did say it was all about moving forward without feeling regrets and giving the best you have, and whatever happens, happens. You know, don't give up. You know, which basically every team meeting, don't give up, right?
Right.
But in this case, they lost so much ground so quickly, and there's a feeling that, hey, it's kind of over here. But so this was kind of a little motivational thing to get them going, but it's just such a stretch for them now to rebound, even in the wild card, and the Dodgers don't seem to be going away. You know, 6.5, 7.5 over the last couple of days. The Dodgers showed in that series at Dodger Stadium that they do just enough to win games, and they have enough pitching. Bullpen has looked a little better lately, and they have the main two guys with Kershaw and Greinke, which the Giants don't have. They only have Bumgarner and whoever might be hot after that, maybe Leak, who knows. But it's a situation where, I kind of suggested the Saturday game was a white flag lineup. Bochy had a number of guys who were kind of new to position. He put Noonan at first base, never played first base.
Right.
Piazza played left, batted cleanup, never batted cleanup. And he had Posey out and Belt out, and Bird out, and Aoki out, all for different reasons. But it wasn't really a white flag lineup as much as he was kind of forced not to play those guys for a variety of health reasons, and Bird just because he wasn't hitting.
Well, they had some positives there. On Sunday, Madison Bumgarner wins his 17th game. Buster Posey finally gets home run number 100. He had waited a while for that. And over the weekend, you saw Angel Pagan get back in the lineup, and you know, he just hit his first home run of the year. He looks like he's moving a little bit better. But overall, the team has been so beat up. Every day, it seems like a new injury. Brandon Crawford doesn't seem to have the same range right now after he got hit in the calf. So, I mean, this team really needs good news, and it looks like they'll get some because Joe Panik is slated to be in the starting lineup on Monday in Arizona against the Diamondbacks. How much is the team looking ahead to that and looking forward to having Joe in the lineup?
Well, it's not a huge upgrade like you would think, Crawford coming back to replace Adrianza, because Shelby Tomlinson has done very well.
Oh, yeah.
He's hit over 300, and while he scuffled defensively at the start trying to learn a new position, he's actually improved to the point where he's capable at second base, including turning double plays. He's got an above-average arm for a second baseman, you know, the former shortstop. Bochy, in fact, is talking about maybe putting him in the outfield next year, whether he's a role player or a utility guy, and he said he definitely could do it. He's got the tools. He got the speed. He got the arm. And obviously, he's got the instincts as an infielder. So that's a situation down the road. But for now, Tomlinson has been fine. Of course, he's no Panic on defense. And by the way, you saw that play at AAA Scottsdale or AAA Sacramento the other day?
Oh, my gosh. Going to his left, but then having to react going back to his right with his bare hand?
I couldn't stop watching that video. And it's just one of the best plays he's ever made. And we're including that World Series flip in Game 7 to Crawford for the double play that kind of ended Kansas City's momentum. Just to describe it, if people haven't seen it, and even if they did, it's hard to explain. Ground ball by the Reno hitter went to between first base and second base, and Kevin Franson, who we all know, was the first baseman. He made a diving attempt. It was just off his glove, and Panic was sort of angling over to his left to make the play. If Franson couldn't, he probably would have made it, but it's off Franson's glove, and Panic is in the outfield. He slides because he has to reverse his momentum. The ball darts to his right, so he can't move his glove over there in time, so he barehands the ball, and in one motion rises to one knee and then flips the throw to first base, and the pitcher is covering. It's a one-hopper. The pitcher makes the play, and it's just fabulous. And this was his first rehab game after a month off rehabbing from lower back inflammation. And I was talking to Ron Wotus. He kind of cringed when he saw this. Oh, my God, this is a guy who probably doesn't need to do that. He's getting off a back injury. But it really proved that maybe he's ready to go here. And he's played three games. He's going to suit up, most likely start against the left-hander, Corbin, Monday in Arizona. So it'll be nice to have a familiar face, Crawford, who missed a whole bunch of games recently with an oblique and a calf. Will have his old partner back up the middle.
Well, him coming back fairly quickly after the rehab anyway kind of reminds me of Hunter Pence, who didn't need a whole lot of time. I mean, at one point he came back off the DL and didn't even use a rehab assignment, but this has been a little different for Hunter Pence with the oblique. It seems to be tricky. What's the latest on Pence trying to come back and help the Giants?
Well, this is the Giants' Ironman of recent years. 162 games, lots of play every inning, the big-time motivator, inspirational leader. And now, unfortunately, he just can't do anything. All he's doing is hitting off a tee. And we're just a few weeks to the end of the season. He's been on the DL for 2.5 weeks with that strained oblique, you know, sustained it on that final swing in the game where he jogged off the field holding his side.
Yeah.
And he hasn't played since then. And it's been 2.5 weeks. And I heard from team officials that they hope to ease him back in slowly, whether it's a pinch hit here, an inning there, two innings here, to the point where maybe when they play the A's in Oakland, he could be the DH. And then for that final week when they play the Dodgers and Rockies to close it out, he could play every day, every inning, and maybe play some defense in right field. But listen, 7.5 back, 25 to go. If it doesn't get any better than that, he's definitely not going to play this year. Even if it does get better than that, he might not play this year, because Bochy said the other day, until I see this guy swing in a real batting practice on field in the cage, I can't really talk about a timetable, because right now there's no reason to have a timetable because he's doing nothing but hitting off the tee. So, you know, nobody's more upset about this than he is. He's with the team. He's stretching in the clubhouse every day. He's talking to teammates. He's trying to do what he can, you know, stand in the dugout and cheer for the team. But that only gets you so far. He needs to be out on the field for this team to be better than they are right now.
Yeah, the fact that he's been out so many games this year has absolutely killed the Giants and their chances. Yet they still have hung in there. Another player who has been out a lot of the year where you expected him to come back and make a great comeback was Matt Cain. And, you know, at the beginning of spring training, right away, you know, he hurt his forearm. And, you know, when he did come back, it looked like he had the same stuff. And then it made you wonder about the mental part of it, because he maybe didn't overcome that hurdle of coming back, and he would make, you know, one bad pitch here or there. In fact, Amy G came on the podcast the other day and said she thought it was mostly mental for Cain. What do you think?
Well, I think it's mostly physical for Cain. I mean, here's a guy who had the elbow surgery and really hasn't been the same since. He couldn't open the season after spring training in the rotation. He came back. He wasn't the same. He couldn't finish innings. He couldn't be efficient. He didn't have his velocity up. His command certainly was off. and that's a sign of physical issues, and he's on the DL again because of the elbow. So anyway, he's had one rehab assignment or appearance with Sacramento. He's going to have a second and final one Monday with Sacramento, and then he's going to join the team with Jeremy Affeldt, two pitchers who will be activated Tuesday, but both of them will be in the bullpen. And Kane, who's been a lifetime starter, a very good one, including in the postseason, which warranted his $100 million plus contract, he's going to be kind of a long man or maybe even a garbage time man in the bullpen because they're not going to trust him to be, you know, in the 7-8-9 rotation if they're up a run or two. They got guys for that situation. Maybe if a pitcher comes out in the third or fourth inning, they could give him a couple innings. But I'm not sure he can be trusted if a game is on the line right now, and he's going to have to prove himself. You're not going to see him in the rotation. He doesn't have the endurance or the stamina or who knows about the velocity and command. You know, that's all going to have to play out, you know, the last few weeks. Hopefully for him, he can finish on a positive note and rest in the offseason and build up his strength again for spring training in 2016. But it's just kind of a sad story with this rotation. So many guys have been in and out. A lot of them have, you know, so many innings, so many years in the big leagues, so many pitches thrown that the wear and tear is kind of affecting them this year. And that goes for quite a few guys in that rotation, except for one man, and that's Bumgarner.
Right. Well, it does include Tim Lincecum, and we'll talk about him when we continue with John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle right after this. Giants fans are settling for nothing but the best these days, so if you're in the market for buying or selling real estate in San Francisco, you will want the A number one real estate agent. Well, at McGuire Real Estate, the top producer is Robert Merriman, and I encourage you to give him a call at 415-351-4698 or check him out at robertmerriman.com. Robert Merriman is opening doors for buyers and sellers in the city, and his excellent service is never discounted. Whether you're a buyer or seller in San Francisco, you need a creative negotiator on your team. Robert Merriman at McGuire Real Estate is the man for the job. Contact Robert at 415-351-4698. That's 415-351-4698. Or robertmerriman.com. Let's talk about Tim Lincecum. And John, you wrote a really interesting column on Timmy, as you quoted his dad, Chris Lincecum. And Chris was quoted in there as saying that he thinks it's going to make a major difference, the surgery that Tim has had on his hip. He said that it'll be stronger and he'll be able to create more leverage. So, you know, this really makes it a fascinating story when you think about the fact that Lincecum wasn't pitching all that well this year after he started out well, but then he wasn't pitching well, and now he has the hip surgery, and you wonder if maybe he can be with the Giants again. There was that question of, you know, he's not pitching well enough to have the Giants warrant him coming back. But now that this happens, it seems like there's a more positive note here, a lot more optimism for Tim to come back in a Giants uniform. What do you think about it?
I thought it was premature of columnists and talk show hosts and fans and a variety of people to come out and say that Lincecum has thrown his last pitch as a Giant. I mean, let's think about this for a while. You know, he's 31. He's not going to make the big money for next year. He had a hip injury and had surgery and fixed something that bothered him this year. And remember, he had a 2.08 ERA through 9 starts.
Yeah.
So he was going fine. And then the hip, you know, just got out of whack. And as we know now, Lincecum had a variety of doctors and opinions before having the surgery. And one of them told him that he was actually having hip issues since he was a youth, since 9 years old, when he just started having the hip grow structurally different. And he's kind of been compensating for it ever since. Now, you know, make no mistake, he's been fine as a pitcher. The golden spikes and all the rings, the Cy Young Awards, the All-Star appearances, you know, superb career. But he's been dealing with that hip, and it kind of bothered him some more late last season, you know, as he told us. But after a few starts this year, you know, we're looking in the mid to late May, it kind of bothered him again. And if you remember that start in Cincinnati, he was actually falling off the mound a few times. And that had to do with his balance and the fact that he wasn't landing properly because he couldn't trust his strength in his hip, because every time he landed, picture him as a right-hander, he pushes off on his right foot and lands on his left. So right. Mechanically, if you want to break this down, he usually, when he's going well, points that foot to the target, to the plate, or a little bit in toward third base. Well, what happened this year when he started going poorly and his mechanics fell out of whack, that left foot opened up and it started pointing toward the first base line.
What a difference, huh?
Yeah, it's a difference, because if you, you know, try it at home, it's a lot different, because now suddenly your knee, your ankle, you know, they're not in a power position. They're kind of in a passive position. So he's landing awkwardly. He's falling off the mound. His release point is off. His stamina is off. His velocity is off. His command is off. Everything's out of whack when the hip is out of the whack. So now, you know, apparently it's fixed and, you know, you can move on. But, you know, my question is, why give up on a guy like this who, in his prime, just got a surgery that might have fixed a problem? I'm not saying he's going to be a Cy Young Award winner. I'm not going to say he's going to throw 97, but with a hip that's fixed, you know, he tore the labrum and he had an impingement in there that was all dealt with. You know, suddenly you have a guy in his prime who is trying to make a comeback and is going to be at a reduced rate. You know, he's not going to make 37 or 35 million over 2 years that he made with this contract. You know, you might see a guy who could help you. Certainly this rotation needs all the help it can get. And if he can work himself back into a third or fourth or fifth starter's role, you know, all the power to him. And why not take advantage of that if you're paying for the rehab anyway? You know, he's under the Giants' control, so the Giants have to pay for his rehab. They have to oversee it. They have to monitor it. It's their job to get him back as a major league pitcher. So why do it for the Padres or the Dodgers or the Angels or the Mariners?
Well, now that he has this new hip, it's almost like he's Lee Majors from the $6 million man. You know, he's rebuilt. He can be better than he was before, as they said in the open to that old show, if you're old enough to remember that. But with Lincecum, the thing that's remarkable to me here is that we never heard about any hip injury. You know, he wasn't pitching all that well after the great start that you mentioned, and he got hit in the arm with the comebacker. And it looked to me like, okay, his Giants career is going to be over. He's going to be lucky to sign with another team somewhere and try to fight for a job. But now there's all this optimism surrounding him because of the new hip that he's getting. So does that make his chances of being a Giant much greater? It seems that way.
Well, I would say so. I spoke with Larry Baer for a story the day he had the surgery in Vail, Colorado, and so many people were calling for a Tim Lincecum Appreciation Day. So I asked him, I said, what about that? He said, well, that's silly. I said, why is it silly? He said, well, it's silly because now you're presuming he's not going to be with the Giants next year. We'd love to have an Appreciation Day for Lincecum, but we want it 10 years from now.
Right.
You know, when he's retired. You know, why have it now and then re-sign him next year? That's kind of bogus. It makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, there's no plan for an Appreciation Day. He's not going to pitch again for the team this year, but they're certainly not going to have this big dramatic thing like they might have had for Zito, a standing ovation and all that stuff. And so then I speak with his father, Chris Lincecum, who actually confirms that Tim does have interest in the team. And Bear didn't rule it out, Lincecum return. He thought that Tim doesn't want to rule it out. And certainly enough, the father, Chris, said that, sure enough, Tim wants to return as a Giant. Hey, he liked it here. He enjoyed the fans, the stadium, the whole ambiance, the surroundings, everything about it. You know, he's a West Coast guy, you know, growing up in Seattle area. So, you know, why not want to return here? You know, he's familiar with the coaching staff and the field and the fans, and he's had success here. So it's not like he's just going to rule this thing out. I mean, it might not work out. Maybe some team will come in and make an offer, give him a situation that is really a preference to him. You know, I'm not sure if he wants to pitch to Seattle, but maybe one of the Southern California teams. Who knows? And maybe the Giants will say, okay, that's enough. Then you can have an appreciation day, whatever. But for now, I don't think either side is saying no to Tim Lincecum returning in 2016, and why would you?
The Freak 2, the sequel. That it could happen. We'll see how that works out. Now, another story that you wrote recently, which caught a lot of attention, and this follows up on the New York Times reporter Eric Lichtblau, who wrote a story about bringing his son to a Cubs game, and after the game trying to get an autograph from Buster Posey, and hanging up a sign, by the way, that said Posey for Prez, which actually doesn't sound like a bad idea right now with the candidates that are out there. But Posey, you know, he was probably not all that thrilled with being swept in that series by the Cubs, and blew past the autograph seekers, went to the bus in Chicago, didn't sign the autograph, and then he catches flack from this New York Times reporter whose son called Posey a jerk, and it just seems completely out of line to me. I mean, how do you know Posey based on that one incident, a guy who does a lot of work off the field, you know, in the community and that kind of thing, and is very accommodating to media, and I'm sure a lot of autograph seekers, maybe just not that one time. So, John, you wrote about this, and you know, this kind of attention is not something that you want. How do you look at it when you're talking about players and autographs and you know, walking to the bus and being hounded for those autographs everywhere they go, basically?
Well, no player or entertainer or musician or actor is going to sign every autograph that is requested. It's just not physically possible
right. Over
a lifetime. And sometimes you're in a rush. You have to catch a bus. Sometimes you're emotionally just not there. Hey, the Giants got swept in Chicago. It was a terrible series. It kind of changed the momentum of their season. And it just wasn't a pretty series. Guys didn't play well. And if you remember, Posey didn't have a great road trip. So now you're thinking, well, after the game, here's some fans. He's kind of walking over to the bus. Here's his dad with a couple of kids. And as it turned out, as the New York Times writer wrote in his essay for Sunday's New York Times, they actually did get about 5 autographs, including Madison Bumgarner's. But the one guy who didn't sign was Posey. And I know Posey enough to say that he's probably in the middle of the pack among Giants who sign autographs.
Okay.
You know, Crawford and Lincecum, when he was around, sign a lot. You know, there are other guys who don't sign hardly at all. Posey's right there in the middle, right? Just saw him yesterday signing, you know, for a group of Giant fans, in fact, in Denver. So anyway, you know, this guy turns out to be an established New York Times investigative reporter, by the way. The guy's won a Pulitzer Prize. He's you know, very well respected, but he just so happened to, on a 1-week journey, look into bringing his kids to 5 or 6 ballparks in 5 or 6 days from the East Coast to Chicago and back. Okay, no big deal, great time. But then he writes about it, and I know, you know, mean no ill will toward this fellow, but it just seemed a little unfair. So I kind of called him on it and wrote about it, and kind of suggested that, you know, autographs are sort of the best and worst that baseball has to offer. It's great to see a kid, you know, right there meeting his, you know, favorite player, and the player gives him the 30 seconds and signs something. Hey, the kid's going to remember that forever, right? You know, what kid does their
right. Grandpas
and grandmas right now who remember getting an autograph, you know, from Stan Musial or whatever. So, You also have the guys who, you know, make a huge profit off autographs and who sometimes send kids to the front line to get the autographs.
Right.
And, you know, who has respect for those guys? But there are also that other group, the parents. And my message to parents is, you know, just be cool. You know, don't push your kid to the front of the scrum. You know, don't yell out the player's last name. You know, don't hold a Posey for Prez sign over your 12-year-old kid's head when he's trying to get Buster Posey's autograph
right. During
a 4-game sweep by the Cubs. So it's just use some common sense. And I would say, hey, if you want to get an autograph, don't do it after the game when all the emotions are all over the place. Do it before the game when players are more at ease, especially in spring training. Anyone will tell you that's the best time. But if you're going to do it during the season, do it hours before, and don't stand there with your kid. Let your kid stand there alone, because Posey and a lot of these guys, I've seen them. I see what they do. If they're a bunch of parents and a couple kids, they're not going to go up to that group. They're going to go up to the group where there's nothing but kids, because those are the genuine fans, the true guys. You know, players and kids, they've always had that understanding, right? But you just kind of stay away, parents. Just 20 feet back, and don't yell Posey. You know, it's either Mr. Posey or Buster. I remember a funny story when I was covering the Padres back in the 80s. This is when I first heard Steve Garvey. You know, we all have stories about Steve Garvey. Well,
right.
Fans would yell at him, "Hey, Garvey, sign," and he would go up to them. "It's Mr. Garvey or Steve, or else I'm not signing." Anyway, I kind of learned from that. And it's just be cool, parents. But, you know, let the kids have their day and kind of stay away from that scene.
And I would say, don't expect to get the autograph. If you get it, great, but you don't expect it. And, something that I learned a little lesson when I was actually 16 years old, and I was telling Mark Purdy the story the other day, that I actually, myself and a couple of buddies, followed Willie McCovey to the airport. We went down to the Players' parking lot, saw his car pulling out, and he was driving towards the airport. I guess he didn't take the bus that day. And we just followed him. And then once we got there, he got out of the car, and we're thinking, now what do we do? We're not going to ask him for an autograph. We're just sitting there, and we're going, okay, well, let's just go home. We followed Willie McCovey. That was cool. But it just makes you think, when you're younger, these guys are larger than life, but you do have to temper your enthusiasm a little bit and not expect them to be your best buddy. That every once in a while they'll sign an autograph. That's great, but you can't expect it.
Yeah, one player came up to me and said, "I really appreciated that story." And he told me an example. He was with his wife in the back of a cab leaving the team hotel. And suddenly he heard this pounding on the window. "Hey, Crawford, can you sign this? I got a ball. Hey, Crawford, can you sign this?" And this is moving traffic, you know. And he's with this kid.
Oh.
And Crawford, you know, trying to politely say, "Hey, I can't right now. I'm with my wife. We're in the back of a cab. We're going to dinner." "Really?" So anyway, the kid starts yelling and screaming, cuss words. And everything. It's like, come on, Dad. You got to be better than that.
Oh.
You know, don't approach that environment. Don't go there. And, you know, unfortunately, that's what happens with some of these parents. They just kind of go a little overboard and think they're entitled to this stuff, where, like you said, you should go to a game and not expect an autograph. Hope for one. If you don't get one, fine. If you get one, it's a bonus. All is well. But if you don't, hey, you just watched a ball game, and, you know, what could be better?
We'll finish up with John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle right after this. Today's interview is being sponsored by Toscolito Tire and Automotive. You have to admit, collecting World Series titles is a new trend for the Giants, but at Toscolito Tire and Automotive, they've been winning since 1971 with quality tires and reliable auto and light truck repair at 6 Bay Area locations near you. Toscolito Tire and Automotive will take care of you like family, and they offer a nationwide guarantee backed by the strength of the Goodyear Tire and Service Network. And unlike watching close Giants games, going to Toscolito equals a stress-free life. No torture at Toscolito Tire and Automotive, with 4 Marin locations, plus the Marina in San Francisco and Vallejo. Toscolito, more than just a tire store. Let's talk about another pitcher in the National League, and that's Matt Harvey, who is getting close to his expiration time as far as innings. Kind of reminds me of the movie.
What is he, a milk carton?
Yeah, or like the movie Logan's Run. Here we go again. I'm going way back in time, but when you die when you're age 30, you're done in that movie. You know, that was your lifespan. So his lifespan was supposed to be 180 innings, and he's at 166 and a third, I believe, going into his next start Tuesday against the Nationals. So, you know, how do the Mets handle this? And Matt Harvey and his agent Scott Boras, they were kind of looking at this with Dr. James Andrews and saying, well, you know, that really is the hard limit, the 180 innings. And Matt Harvey was very noncommittal with reporters in the story that was written in the New York Times on Sunday, but then he came out later on Sunday in the Players Tribune. That's the website that has been started by Derek Jeter, where athletes just write their own stories. And he said, I'll be ready for the playoffs. But it's still up in the air as to how they will handle this as far as the innings, the rest of the season. The Mets are trying to, you know, finish off the Nationals there. It's very dicey. And John, you look at what happened with Steven Strasburg, and that was 3 years ago, and then the Nationals didn't get into the World Series. They shut him down. I don't know. What do you think of this? This sounds like, you know, it's one of those things that if the Giants were to handle it, they'd figure out a way to do it right and have that pitcher ready to go in the postseason. How come the Mets are having so much trouble?
Well, the Giants haven't been like other teams. They haven't had a rash of Tommy John surgeries for whatever reason.
True.
And I don't know if it's luck or the San Francisco water or a couple of words from Rigetti that might tell them something. Who knows? Mechanically, I don't know. But they've been very fortunate. The A's have had a bunch of Tommy Johns. Most teams have had a bunch of Tommy Johns. Now, there have been some minor leaguers over the years in the Giants organization who have had these elbow reconstructive surgeries. But for the most part, you know, Lincecum and Kane and Bumgarner and Jonathan Sanchez and these older guys, you know, Tim Hudson did have it, but he was a Brave at the time. So it's not like Giants pitchers are lining up for this surgery. So it's just a different mindset. And Sunday, Madison Bumgarner pitched. He threw six innings. He's up to 188 pitches. He wants to throw 200 innings. He wants to win 20 games. He's got 17. He's three away. He has five starts. He's different. He's a, you know, obviously his agent isn't Scott Boras,
right?
Because if it was, maybe he would feel differently, because Boras communicates with his clients, and like Steven Strasburg a couple of years ago with Washington, and now Matt Harvey with the Mets. In the wake of Tommy John surgery, he wants to limit the innings. Well, the team doesn't want to limit the innings. Washington would have been much better with Strasburg in the postseason a few years ago, and Harvey obviously makes the Mets a lot better. But when suddenly they say, well, there's an 188 or 180 pitch or inning limit, this is one of our best guys and we need him for the postseason. The question is, how often do you have chances, even though 10 out of 30 teams get in now, to get to the postseason? Well, if you're the Mets, not often, right?
Right, hasn't been since 06.
The Nationals with Strasburg, not often, right?
Right.
And, you know, the Giants before this run, three times in 5 years, not often. So it seems like when you get that chance, you ought to go for it. And that's what the teams want to do. But there's so many outside influences now, from agents to doctors to players themselves who want a long career and therefore more money, a bigger legacy. Well, what's your legacy when you kind of give up in September and don't pitch anymore? I mean, that's kind of what Strasburg is going to be remembered for, and maybe now Harvey. But you're saying Harvey wants to pitch beyond the 180 innings, and that's probably good news for Sandy Alderson.
Well, yeah. I mean, wait, at first you heard that maybe he didn't want to pitch because Scott Boras came out and said about, you know, something about the hard cap. So it's kind of confusing. It's mixed messages. But I know one thing, John. I'll make this analogy. Let's just say I was going to get married and I had my wife-to-be sitting there waiting for me at the church and I ran into traffic. And if I'm late to this wedding, she's walking out. I'm never going to be married to her and I'm never going to see her again. I'm going to drive probably 75, 80 miles an hour, whatever it takes. It might be a risk to get a ticket. It might be a risk that I'm going to die in an accident, but I'm going to get there. And that's what I look at with this. I mean, it's just, I've got to take that chance. You got to take a risk sometimes in life. Strasburg, wasn't his fault. They told him, you know, you're not pitching, but they didn't take the risk there. Look what happened with Harvey. You know, you got to take the risk.
Yeah, quite an analogy. Yeah.
I know, sometimes I'm crazy, but you know what are you
gonna
do?
Yeah, sometimes. You're right. It's a situation where the team thought one way with Harvey and the agent thought another way. And the agent is kind of saying, well, that's not me talking, Scott Boras. That's Dr. Andrews talking. And whether that's true or not, I don't know, because Andrews isn't the most talkative guy. He doesn't want to get in the middle of agent versus team versus general manager here. So we haven't heard much from him. It's been mostly Alderson and Boras going at it, and Harvey's stuck in the middle. It's unfortunate, but It's just, I go back again to that fact. How often do you get the chance? And why not take advantage of it? A lot of these guys have big contracts, and you could get Tommy John surgery after 10 innings. It doesn't matter. There's no magic number. I mean, God knows what the magic number is. I don't know if Scott Boras does. 180? Why is it 180? Why shouldn't it be 160 or 190? But to say 180, that's where you cut him off, it's kind of ridiculous.
It is kind of ridiculous. Well, John, thanks so much for your time tonight. By the way, now you and Mark McGwire have something in common, apparently. You know, we had a technical difficulty tonight, so we had to re-rack and do this whole thing again. I think the second time around was better. But you were relaying a story in between there to me about Lon Simmons and an interview with Mark McGwire that they did twice.
Well, I guess you and I had to do a little bit of this over now that the whole world knows. And it reminded me of, you know, the great Lon Simmons. He was telling me once, and back then they are not using what you're using now. They just little $12 handheld microphone, right?
Right.
The tape recorder. And anyway, he had this long pregame interview with Mark McGwire back when he broadcast the A's with Bill King. And he got back up to the press box and played it. I said, boy, there's nothing there. You know, the thing's busted. So anyway, he went back down to McGwire and told him, and McGwire was nice enough to do the whole interview over.
Wow.
So Lon enjoyed his A's days as much as his Giant days. You just don't hear about them as much, though he did call that World Series championship victory over the Giants in 89, and McGwire was part of that, so he had a nice bond with those guys.
Oh, it's great that we could get a Lon story in here before we were done. John, thank you so much. Appreciate it, and I will see you at the next homestand.
Thanks, Joe.
That's John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle. Join us again on Wednesday for another edition of Inside China Basin. For now, I'm Joe Castellano. Thanks for listening on thesportsvirus.com.